Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust. Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of Elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit EnduranceWarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's EnduranceWarranty.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Why aren't men reading? Ursula K. Le Guin is literally asking this question in the essay.
There's a hierarchy of needs, and reading is not all the time the top of the hierarchy. It doesn't appeal to us because we have properly nourished our imagination where we desire a greater, more nourishing fruit.
Now, you outdid yourself there, sir. That was pretty nasty and pretty pretentious. Hello, welcome back to another To The Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm the other host, Richard.
Why are Americans afraid of dragons?
Why don't men read anymore?
Ooh, Ursula K. Le Guin was asking this question in an essay she wrote back in 1974. The title of said essay was Why Are Americans Afraid of Dragons? It is one of her essays in this book called The Language of the Night. It's couple pages to what, a dozen, 10 pages, 7 pages in the physical copy, not long at all.
Yeah, I think I read it on the PDF, so 5 pages in total.
This is going to be, we're going to give the background of the article, explain what it says, our opinions on it, and this is a spoiler warning type thing. This is just Ursula Quay's essay on her thoughts of why weren't men reading, why reading is so essential, especially fantasy.
Just clarifying, you're not giving a spoiler warning.
No.
Good. Because I thought you were, and I was going to like, you're taking a little too far.
No, this is not one of those things where it's a narrative or a book that we're going to give you our spoiler-free book. No, this is an essay that you should go read in the description below. Either read it before watching this or afterwards. We're going to discuss it. And we're going to get a little geeky on this one again. We've been in the essay territory for a little bit because these small articles of sorts pack a punch. And this one packed a punch for me. How did you like the essay?
I did. I can definitely tell the date of it. This is interesting for me. I see both my father in this essay. I see like this essay being written in 1974. I get its time. I'm curious on how you're taking it on its value now.
Right.
Is it still true in 2025? I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's still something to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
I at the very least, I don't know how, if it's the same situation as it was, but I think it's still somewhat true today.
You're right, where it definitely speaks to the era. This definitely reads as if it was written in 1974. Mm-hmm. I think it's a lot, the core of it is still very applicable.
Yes.
And it's cool to see what observations Ursula K. Le Guin was making at the time, because you'll see in our thumbnail of this video, we say, why aren't men reading? Ursula K. Le Guin is literally asking this question in the essay, and you see a sort of trend today. This is, you'll see it on Twitter, X, wherever. You'll see it on BookTok, BookTube. This topic of why aren't bookstores marketing toward men? Why is it a chicken and egg thing? Is it the publishers and marketers aren't serving men, or is it men aren't reading enough? This is a conversation happening today. And you look back in 1974, clearly this is a conversation that didn't just sprout in 2020 to 2020s. I thought that was just interesting enough because we read this not... This was an accidental read of somebody recommended, hey, you guys have been into Tolkien and C.S. Lewis articles. What about Ursula K. Le Guin stuff?
Yeah.
So, and reading this, I went, oh, this is very relevant to today. Did you find the same? It was just as relevant, or you said it spoke to your dad in a way. What did you mean by that?
Oh, I've just, as Ursula K. Le Guin in this article or in this essay is talking about how the ultimate question of when someone who doesn't read a lot of fantasy or sci-fi will ask you, well, what's it for? What does it do for you? Does it, you know, is it improving your skills? Is it improving your social class? Is it making you more money? Like, what's the purpose of it? What's the point? I've heard my dad from that of like, you know, there's great literature, but there's a lot of stuff out there which like it's just entertainment or, you know, it's fantasy. So it's like pointless.
I've heard that from a fellow dick as mine, too.
Yeah,
you've said that plenty of times. You have a very particular way of saying this is literature, this is not, and you command which one is worth your time.
Thing is, both are worthy of time. Like, entertainment is of value. That is a thing.
Not self-help
value.
Not two in a row.
Not two in a row.
No. You have your limit.
There's a rule, and the rule is... The rule is there for everyone, but it's mainly there for certain people. You know what I mean?
You're trying to help them out of their self-help.
There are people out there that could handle two self-help books in a row. The rule's not for them. The rule is for the other people that just keep reading self-help books and never actually helping themselves because they get the dopamine hit of like, ooh, I was so productive because I read a self-help book. And it's like, you didn't do shit.
You're speaking to somebody right now, and they know you're speaking to them.
I'm speaking to a specific person on the self-help thing.
Now, Ursula K. Le Guin would, and I assume you would not say that for fantasy, of don't read two fantasy books in a row. Don't read two sci-fis in a row.
No.
Her whole point here is that this is the most truthful thing that you can actually read. I love her quote at the end of this. I hate to start at the end. This is the last line it really sticks with you, and we'll give you the build up in this essay of how she gets here. So the essay ends with her saying, "It is by such statements as 'Once upon a time there was a dragon,' or 'In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit.' It is by such beautiful non facts that we fantastic human beings may arrive in our peculiar fashion at the truth." Oh,
very much. Is a continuation, or I'm sure Ursula K. Le Guin read Tolkien's essay on fairy stories.
All positive,
because
yeah.
Very much very similar thesis statement, but her angle is going a little bit more of an analytical eye toward men at the time. Do you think that is applicable still today, of the stereotype of men being far more mission focused and like just an aversion to fiction in general, seeing it as a very feminine exercise rather than reading, say, a book on finance, a book to learn some skill to, you know, accomplish a goal? It basically also, I think it's something applicable to, you see men's self-help online content is also a similar vein sometimes. And that's not me like knocking against, you know, self-improvement, but there's a type of the person who's like, yeah, you know, like rise and grind, like only
get that grind set.
Only like have a super efficient time scale, only do work. You need to work from sun up to sundown. No room for
entertainment. What's that viral guy, Ashton Hall? Or something that had the morning routine that went viral.
The funny one, yeah.
That was like something with bananas and then got up at 3 a.m. and by 3:02 a.m. finished their work day by 3:04 a.m. Just that hyper efficiency.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious. Like, that seems to be almost the exact type of thing that Ursula K. Le Guin's talking about.
Yeah, the title of this is almost a misnomer, but she says, "Why are Americans afraid of dragons?" She talks about American, but then it should be, "Why are American men afraid of dragons?" Because she says there's four characteristics in here that are related. These are American characteristics. It's our Puritanism, our work ethic, our profit-mindedness, and even more, our sexual mores. Those four things.
Sexual mores.
Mores. Okay. Yes. I was saying mores the whole time I read it. So no. Good. Mores.
Mores.
So Ursula K. Le Guin there is saying that the rejection of the entire art of fiction, and more specifically fantasy, she says, but of fiction in general is seen in such a negative light to American men because of those four things. And she breaks that down by saying the Puritan values and this American mindset, which she's speaking in 1970s. We can bring that to today's conversation. But she says this: to read War and Peace or The Lord of the Rings plainly is not work. You do it for pleasure. And if it cannot be justified as educational or as self-improvement, then in the Puritan value system, it can only be self-indulgence or escapism. For pleasure is not a value to the Puritan. On the contrary, it is a sin. That's the line she says there. What do you think about that? Because the highlights there is that basically the Puritan value is looking at hedonism, self-indulgence. If this is thing for enjoyment, you are participating in more of a sin than something that is actually valuable to your life.
Yeah, I mean, in general, balance is the right key here. I mean, there are plenty of people out there, everyone knows, like, that someone who's too self-indulgent, who only is only willing to deal with immediate pleasure and is not willing to delay gratification for a greater, higher goal. That's a lot of people, ourselves included. So, but then the other side of the stick is, yeah, never allow yourself to have any type of pleasure and not allowing yourself to have fun. Yeah, you're going to burn out and break. So, yeah, it's a folly to think that you can't have pleasure in your life and to classify that as a sin. If you were to maybe say anything, maybe certain types of pleasure would be a vice. And vices are something to be controlled, but not necessarily, you know, excised from your life. A vice and sin are not necessarily like one in one. A vice wouldn't more be, or a sin would be a vice taken to its uncontrollable extreme. Does that kind of make sense?
So you're saying a vice is something like, as in gambling. You can gamble and it could not be an issue or an addiction. If you go, I'm going to do a fun, here's 10 bucks on this, and then you don't. It's a bad thing. It's a vice, but it's not that you indulged. Is that what you're saying? The sin is the worst, the extreme. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Now we're taking more anecdotal, just secular talk of this.
Anecdotal is facts, though.
Sure. No, this is a secular look at it rather than a religious aspect, but in terms of religion, from at least my interpretation from friends talking to me about it, of like liquor is a common thing. Of liquor is a vice, and for some people that vice can be almost sinful in nature. Some people can't control their vice, and that could be sinful. And that can lead to, gluttony and lead to a bunch of other things. But it's individual. It's individual in nature. So some people can handle it, some people can't. I'm wondering if fantasy books, you see the amount we read of like, is it a sin at a certain point where you're only reading it and you shirk other responsibilities to a great degree that you're only reading fantasy?
And Le Guin's arguing that this Puritan mindset is why American men didn't or don't typically read fiction, because it is seen as something that is for simple pleasures. She says at one point in the essay, I'll probably bring it up again, but how the American man would be satisfied looking at saying, hey, we have a colored TV, we have two cars, I'm providing all this value, and sure, my wife can go and read her romance books, could her soap operas that she watches, and look at it that way, where that is just entertainment. Because the mindset she's talking about is if something is just entertainment, where you go and you play a video game and it's just fun, it's an escape for you, and that kind of mindset. I'm curious what she'd say today, because you look at book reading compared to doom scrolling and TikToks and social media, and books are not even close to being seen in that respect. There's a lot worse you can do for pleasure.
That is true.
In your time today.
The times have changed. Even the trashiest of is the trashiest novels.
Yeah.
Ursula K. Le Guin was talking about how if The American Man reads in 1974, it would be a pulpy Western or, say, a crime drama or some self-help book, because all those things are real. You know, self-improvement is something that directly affects your life. The nonfiction, like a crime drama, well, crime really does exist. It's real. It's something. The, you know, fantasy, the first one I said, but the last one I did.
Mm-hmm. Say again?
We started out Westerns. You know, the cowboy used to be real. And so it is still in reality. It's just not true. A lot of those pulpy Westerns just lack any type of substance of truth. And to Ursula K. Le Guin, that's actually a highlight of it. That it's not, you know, to be true, it needs a little bit of the fantastical. You need to be reaching a little deeper in the imagination, and that is to be repulsed. But yeah, nowadays, you take the trashiest book, and it still doesn't compare to the other options available today.
And people could certainly read for just pleasure. Obviously, on this,
we've gone for pleasure all the time. Primary.
Read for pleasure. I think the point she's making about this is just the first of her three or four points of why American men don't read this Puritan mindset. I think the reason I read is almost contrary to this, because I don't see books as just pleasure. If books was just pleasure, which it certainly is, it certainly is fun, especially when you're reading a good book. I see what Le Guin also sees is a value beyond just it being fun. It's why if I read for hours and hours and hours throughout a day, or it's a 6-hour reading session, I'll often not feel guilty about that. Whether that's I've been conditioned to feel so, or society tells me reading's good, whatever that might be. If I read for a long period of time, I'm not then looking back going, what a waste of time. Even if it's a bad book. I read another book.
Do you think that applies to all books that you've read? Or there's some books where you go, maybe I shouldn't have spent 6 hours reading this book.
It applies to all books for me.
Really? Yeah. All books?
Yeah. I haven't had a time, and this is what I try to do with my hobbies, or spending time on things. And if I spent 6 hours playing a video game, personally, I would look and go, all right, I should have done other responsibilities. I should have done... Yeah, you can read for too long. However, you can often tell... You can often tell what's a good or bad thing to do, always in hindsight, with how much you regret spending time doing that thing. Mm-hmm. And why I've always gravitated towards reading is it's also one of those things that with all the entertainment options and with all the things you can spend your time doing, books feel more rewarding to me. Books feel as in, even if it's a bad book or something that is just straight up entertainment, romp, etc., for me, the value is, I get another perspective on, I want to write as well. So it has some value as I want to learn about writing craft, even if it's learning what not to do. Or we get to discuss on here, or just simple conversation. If someone else has read the book, that's something that I read and I can insert myself in the conversation somehow, versus playing a video game for 6 hours. I'm a huge gamer. I was a huge gamer. So no flags whatsoever at gamers. But if I play Clash Royale for 6 hours, that doesn't do much for me socially outside of just playing the game for 6 hours. There's always some excuse I could make to be, there's some value outside of just entertainment. And basically what Le Guin says later in this essay, I 100% agree with, of why I value fiction and value fantasy. But do you find yourself thinking the same thing? Is the book reading, do you see it as this pleasure-seeking thing that she says that the American man was, especially in the 1970s, because I think times have changed with technology, but do you see it when you read as just pleasure or a lot of pleasure? What's your pleasure percentage when you read?
It depends on the
book. How much do you please yourself?
How much do I please myself? Yeah. It depends on the book, but it also depends on other things I have to do. Because I definitely see there is a point to the whole idea of like the Puritanian culture of like in a high stress society, if there is you know, in times of war, in times of great famine, where a lot of whatever it has to be, like a lot of work's got to get done, of not just, you know, work for the mind, but no, the crops need to get picked. The widget factories need to be made, and we, like, or else everybody's starving. There's a time and place of like when then you see if you're like working 12-hour shifts of like just trying to get food on the table and you're like barely keeping it together.
Well, just put an audio book in, loser.
Yeah. Then you look over at the someone your same age and like helping hand going, I did my 8 hours and I'm reading a book for the next four. And you go, you fucker. Like, help us. We're starving. There's a point. There's a point to be like, there's a hierarchy of needs, and reading is not all the time the top of the hierarchy. Food and shelter is more important. So sometimes there's a point to that.
Maslow would agree. Yeah.
But even in the 1970s, life's pretty, shelter's good. Food's pretty good. Like, even then, we made such great strides in, you know, dominating world hunger as a problem.
Well, she's also speaking to the American man who does. They're talking about the person who goes to work, comes back, and she says in the article, the essay, the man who says, "Hey, we have a colored TV, we have several kids and several cars. Like, look at all this that I'm providing. I don't need that for my pleasure. I need things that are improving myself." So all those basic needs are met. It's then, what do you do in that? What's the top of the hierarchy? Is it self-actualization?
Yeah.
One of those things that we're already at that layer of the pyramid. It's then, what do you do with your time? And she's arguing to that point of what is valuable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for the most part, men, I mean, this is both men and women value things dependent on the other. Men value having nice cars, a house, and provide for it. All of this is like, the wife's inclusion in this is also a factor. The wife also wants a nice house. The wife wants color TV, two cars, all of these things. If the husband doesn't provide it, it could be a sticking point in a relationship. So it's not men are isolated of like, you know, the wife going there going, hey, just read a book. You don't need to get the second car. You don't need to work on that promotion.
I was going to leave this whole pressure. Podcast if you didn't upgrade the seats. This was a thing I also needed. You might have bought them, but I, as the... No, am I the wife here? That's not good. But I increased my value, too, of, I'm comfortable now.
Yeah.
Yes, look, we have colored TVs.
We do have colored TVs.
We do.
Great.
It's actually, and comfy chairs.
You know what is hilarious? That nowadays, the non-colored screens are more expensive.
Oh,
the e-ink screens? E-ink screens are way more expensive than LCD.
As in a pad, not TV.
I spend way too much money on e-ink screens.
Your whole phone's an e-ink screen now.
I know. I love it. I bought a second e-ink screen phone.
When did you do that?
A while ago.
I'm glad you hid it from me. I would have scolded you again for...
You probably should.
Spending your own money on things when you say, man, Austin,
when I could be spending it on you.
That's right. Hey, you could have gotten me a higher footrest.
Yeah, I could have gotten you a nicer place to put your laptop.
It's actually very comfy.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, you also got this. Wow. All the benefits of the studio are great. Wow.
Yeah. This audio has been improved because I spent money.
On that thing.
On that thing. That's right there. So it's out of frame.
Which, to the second point that Ursula K. Le Guin makes, she's saying, again, the rejection of the entire art of fiction is because of the American characteristics for men is, one, their Puritanism, second, their work ethic, and third, their profit-mindedness. So talking about their work ethic and profit-mindedness, her second point speaks to the businessman.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, you're not being a good businessman, maybe.
Oh, I never have been.
So she
never
says...
Will be.
In the businessman's value system, if an act does not bring an immediate, tangible profit, it has no justification at all. Thus, the only person who has an excuse to read Tolstoy or Tolkien is the English teacher, because he gets paid for it. But our businessman might allow himself to read a bestseller now and then, not because it's a good book, but because it is a bestseller. It is a success. It has made money. To the strangely mystical mind of the money changer, that this justifies its existence, and by reading it, he may participate a little in the power and mana of its success. If this is not magic, by the way, I don't know what is.
I love that statement. That's such a good line. I love the idea of, one, I do know that type of person. Of they will read the bestseller, and you ask, like, why? And it's because, well, it's a bestseller. I may be able to glean something off of it. It has sold a lot of copies. There must be something I can, must be something of value there, more so than another book that is, you know, highly recommended, but ultimately not a bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen those people too.
And that's why you'll see the delineation she makes where American men could read more nonfiction because they see that as valuable. Of you read the economics thing or the self-help books or something that you can get immediate tangible effects to your life rather than, oh, there's just that fiction book, that fantasy, all that stuff that what's a dragon going to do for my 401k?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a point to be made on that of there are only 24 hours in a day. And if you do have large aspirations or goals, like anything worth doing takes a lot of time. A lot of time, and you just have to cut things out of your life. If you really want to accomplish something big and important to you, it's going to take time. And if you have to put food on the table and a roof over your own head, you have even less time. And so you only have so many hours of quote-unquote free time in the day. What are you going to spend them on? Spend it on what you find most valuable. And sometimes that won't be fantasy books. Sometimes that won't be your side hustle or hobby. It does really depend on what you value at that moment.
Thing is, I could totally see somebody looking at what I value the most, other than loved ones, of being books and literature and stories, and looking at that like, you freaking idiot.
Yeah.
They're just books. And me going, but they're books.
But they're books.
And this is why the essays from Tolkien on fairy stories, which we discussed, and this one, again, we'll get to our points, but why she expresses in words what I can't do myself of why justifying this hobby is valuable.
One of these days, you're going to read enough essays and you'll be able to express it yourself.
Well, the thing is, I can only do that by quoting them exactly. So I'll have to pull up the laptop and go, okay, what did she say? Which, here's the third one she said. She talked to the Puritan, the businessman. And I know the last reason are sexual mores. Our sexual mores. So she says this, that this is why the American man isn't reading. The last element, the sexual one, is more complex. I hope I will not be understood as being sexist if I say that within our culture, I believe that this anti-fiction attitude is basically a male one. The American boy and man is very commonly forced to define his maleness by rejecting certain traits, certain human gifts and potentialities, which our culture defines as womanish or childish. And one of these traits or potentialities is, in cold sober fact, the absolute essential human faculty of imagination. Remember this part of the essay where she's talking about just how men are taught to stomp down their imagination as they grow up more. And American boys, do you agree with that statement? And looking at the 70s, do you think that's something that was true then that isn't now, or is it true then and now?
I mean, it's all about degrees. It was certainly to some degree true then, to some possibly different degrees true now. But at least in my experience, it's not about stomping on little boys' imagination, but it's hammering into their head to not be a burden. That's the primary objective of man, is do not be a burden, be actually someone that can be burdened upon. That you will lift the burden of others. That is your goal. That is your primary function. And to do that, you need to have money. You need to be independent. You need to grow. You need to be able to provide
things. How does imagination help all that?
How does now, for the businessman, hey, you need an imagination to come up with a fancy business. But in many other
facets, get the woman to do that.
Hey, there we go. Great combo. Man, muscles, and woman, imagination, together. Man, woman, strong. Wheel of time. We are compliments.
Didn't need to read 14 books to learn that. Okay, anyways.
Basically. But no, imagination is, I can see it. I at least didn't have that experience in my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So What about yourself?
No, we're both
reading.
We're biased because we are the American man who is reading. And now it must acknowledge men read less fiction than women do, or less fantasy in general than women do. The bookstores, whether it's the chicken and the egg thing of dominated by woman-centric fiction or fantasy. Romanticism is a huge thing. Now, again, that's a conversation about, is it just because women read more, which they typically do, or is that a result? You have a point.
Oh, go ahead. Keep going.
So that's one thing to put aside. Then the main point for Rich and I is we both do read a bunch. We are the guys who are into fantasy and nerd and geeking out about this. However, we grew up in a completely different era than Le Guin's talking about here. But I do think it's still true that socially speaking, it's what she's speaking to does speak true, that it's typically a male trait or a male trait to push down imagination or push down some sort of, she actually defines what she means by imagination. She says it's the free play of the mind, both intellectual and sensory. Now, I see that as the American man she's talking about, it's very true. Because, you said, your dad, who isn't the exact man she's talking about, but you can think of that American guy, businessman, who does look down at fantasy or just doesn't read it because doesn't find the value in that kind of imagination and that process, which I could see being associated with a man's trait. And I think this is one of those things that there's still some truth to it today, but was much more true back in 1970 than it was today. That's a thing it's slightly dated. However, it's still there. I can still see that for, depending where you grew up. This is a big, it depends thing. But what do you think?
Yeah, it certainly does. And this was actually giving me, so I was thinking about this question of, is the popular publishing industry not catering to men and therefore men don't read, or is it the opposite of, men don't read as much, so publishing houses are not catering to them? Which one came first? And my initial thought on this is, if this is a more advanced modern problem, I would think it just has to do with video games, because you look at video game numbers, and other than certain mobile games, video games is dominated by men. Just pure numbers-wise, men play more video games than women by a wide margin, and that takes time. Video games is a huge time sucker. Like, it sometimes more so than books.
Oh, yeah.
And books take a lot of time.
Yep.
Comparing books and games to something like a TV show or movies, TV show and movies is far lower on your time investment scale versus books and video games take so much more time. And so if more men are playing video games, they're going to have less time to read books. That was just kind of my thought of maybe this is just more of a modern issue, but this essay gave me a bit more of a perspective of 1974, the same issue. Maybe it isn't just video games. Maybe it is something deeper.
Well, you also walk into a video game store, mainly if you walk into a bookstore in the manga section, you just see big old titties right in front of you. I think that's targeted toward men. If you just see
big old biggies those are mostly men.
Yes.
There's some cultured women out there that appreciate. But, for the most part.
If you're a true woman, you'd appreciate it. But you walk into the manga section, you'll see a bunch of covers like that still. I walk into Barnes & Noble and see that.
Sex sells.
Yes, sex sells. Wow. And on the opposite, that's why you go into romanticism and you just see a chiseled jaw, shirt off, abs showing, boy meets girl. Who's that target
well, here's
toward,
the thing.
I think?
It's not. Generally, in terms of attraction, men are far more visual. Women are far more mindful. It is about the situation. It just takes different strokes for different folks. Whatever gets your rocks off. But no, that's when you pitch a spicy romance book.
Yeah.
Is the cover going to have just an image of the guy with rock hard abs? Sometimes, but that's not as common or necessary. It's more you read the back or you get a description from a friend and you hear the type of guy and you go, yes, I'm there for it. That's, and then for a guy, you don't need, you know, a guy doesn't explain like this beautiful woman with bazongas out to here
has the best personality.
That's just not how you draw in most guys. It's just tig old biggies. Yeah. And then there you go. And then you're off to the races.
We were just having a conversation. What was it two days ago? 2 days ago, we were having this conversation. We were hanging out with our friends who happened to be the patrons as well. That's how we met them like years ago. Yeah. And we were hanging out with our friends. And so, and I won't say her name, but we were talking about who our celebrity crushes were, right? And people were going down the line. And somebody answered their celebrity crush. Somebody else did. And I came to my turn. I said, you know what? This person would be like, oh, they're pretty attractive. And as people were looking up a picture of her, one of the women in the group, she's hilarious. She says, she just doesn't have a personality to her. And I'm going, I wasn't talking about her personality. I don't think when you say you're talking about a crush. Yeah. I wasn't paying attention to two large personalities in front of her.
The thing is, I understood her mind of going like her, like
that was totally understood. Yeah.
Like you can look at some celebrities' faces and their face tells a story of like, oh, this person is weird, quirky. Like that person has a personality.
Yeah.
No, like someone with that type of face doesn't have a dull personality. They just can't. It's impossible.
They just have a look.
And that's attractive to people. Mm-hmm. For a lot of guys, we're like, I don't need their face to have a personality. That's not what I'm looking for. That's not the primary objective.
Yes. But it was it's just funny to see how the mind works. And when we're talking about this, how do we even get into this topic? Okay, because men not reading, who's it being targeted toward? And this American consumer businessman who's going, oh, I don't see the value in reading this kind of thing, blah, 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 blah. That was the sexual mores. That's how we started on
more.
This. The sexual more.
I'm going to get you there.
Is that Italian? That's amore is love in Italian. Is that what it's saying?
I don't know where it's from. It's sexual mores.
But that whole, to wrap up that section, do you think that is true? Just on a baseline, is there truth to it?
Yeah, there is. And I just don't know how much it is applicable today. Yeah. I think in general it has gone down significantly, except there is a hyper. I know that community, those type of people exist within the like online self-improvement sphere.
Yeah.
Like as much as I like Alex Hormozi, I love Alex Hormozi. I think he's a cool YouTuber, but mainly cool businessman guy. Is in that self-improvement circle. I like him because I think he's not exactly the same as a bunch of others. But you see the videos he types talks about, like, in general, he would not be reading fantasy books. It's more of trying to focus on excising everything out of his life that doesn't directly improve his business, his health, and, like, his relationship directly. It's like, hyper-focused on business and improvement.
Do you think this would ring true for a man like him where Le Guin says that this is what American men consume? The man who refuses to read novels because it's unmanly to do so or because they aren't true will most likely end up watching bloody detective thrillers on the television or reading hack westerns or sports stories or going in for pornography from Playboy on down. It is his starved imagination craving nourishment that forces him to do so. But he can rationalize such entertainment by saying that it's realistic. After all, sex exists and there are criminals and there are baseball players and there used to be cowboys, and also by saying that it is viral. Virile, by which he means that it doesn't interest most women. And whereas the American woman, she is allowed to read novels and even fantasies, but lacking training and encouragement, her fancy is likely to glom on two very sickly fodder, such as things as soap operas, true romances, nursery novels, historical sentimental novels, and all the rest of the baloney ground out to replace genuine imaginative works by the artistic sweatshops of a society that is profoundly distrustful of the uses of the imagination. And I want to go back to the part about men there where that I thought that was a powerful way that Le Guin put it, that she says that man will go to things such as Westerns or sports or pornography because of man's starved imagination and is craving nourishment and does that in form. Because you're lacking that nourishment, lacking that, you go to things that are actually worse for you anyways. That mm-hmm. I'm sure all this American man you're talking about who likes to think they're being the most productive and doing things that are realistic and real, and this is actually giving value to your life. Well, is that person still watching porn? Or are they still watching the Western slops out there? Are they still doing all these things which are less valuable likely than a lot of the other fiction that would be out there? That I, at this point, when she was building up the argument of the Puritan, the businessman, then the sexual mores, I was going like, oh, this is something that is true in the 1970s. I can see how it's applicable today. But until she put it that way is when it clicked and I went, I see exactly what she means. And mm-hmm. that's where she started to convince me of her point, strongly so, because this is a modern issue as well. That's going to be timeless. Sex is always going to sell. All of these things that we might be talking about, how valuable is reading fantasy or how valuable is reading fiction, but we're assuming that that person isn't seeking other entertainment, which they are. It's yeah. just, it's a choice of entertainment. It's a choice of what the fiction, the things that someone would see as not true is cast aside, but you spend your time craving these worse forms of it. That certainly pornography is significantly less value. And to yeah. me, well, there's no comparison to from pornography to fantasy books. And plenty of people spend time in the way she puts it of, again, you are craving that to fill the gap of your imagination. I liked how she put that. Did you think the same? Because this is the point where I was starting to go, oh, you're spitting, Le Guin, you're spitting.
There was the parts before I was looking and going, yes, certainly a lot of truth to it, but maybe not as applicable to today.
Mm-hmm.
That point in particular did actually speak to me, and also what it is today.
Yeah.
This will be very pretentious of me, but
no.
I think it applies to both of us. Oh. I think you and I will share this pretentiousness.
I will be the judge of that.
Because we have been properly feeding our imagination,
uh-huh.
that when it comes to a lot of slop and crap, imaginative stuff, like the cheap crap.
Okay, yeah.
The cheap stories, the stories we see on TV or movies that have just generally poor writing and just live in the, you know, the boring reality, it doesn't appeal to us because we have properly nourished our imagination where we desire a greater, more nourishing fruit.
Now, you outdid yourself there, sir. That was pretty nasty and pretty pretentious. That was next level.
Yeah. And I think you agree with me.
I'd say it in less pretentious words, but probably we get in the same spot. I'd masquerade it. I'd masquerade it.
Yeah. I made the attempt to make it as pretentious as possible.
You did well. Wow. I don't even like myself after you said that.
Simple thing is yeah. I watch many movies, and then I look at my friend who doesn't read as many books, and they watch a movie and go, wow, that was really entertaining. And then I look at it going, that was fucking snoozeville. Like, my God, the dialogue sucked. Oh, the plot was boring as hell. Not interesting at all. And I'm going, well, I've been reading books that have far more intricate plots, generally. You have more interesting in-depth characters because you have the time with it. Generally, authors will spend a good amount of time on the dialogue, and you read some good books with dialogue. A lot of stuff you're going to see on the TV is just not as entertaining.
Jaden, you're getting jaded.
In a good way. I tasted the finer things. Mm. I am not interested in the slop. Often.
The beautiful thing about that is
sometimes. There's some slop that will slip in there. I'm going like, I know these are potato chips, but I can't help myself. I love it.
The beautiful thing about that is, that's generally, the more you read, the more you watch, the more it needs to impress you in a way if you've seen a lot of things. That can happen. The things that really get me going or surprise me is when I watch something that on the surface is simple
mm-hmm.
and just I love it just as much as those complex things or the intricate dialogue that I read that I think I know so much about, because there's a the more movie examples than book examples, I could give book examples like, oh, Red Rising, I still love it. People wouldn't see that as high literature. But the examples of like Godzilla Minus One as a film is pretty simple. It's one of my
favorite.
It's a five-star, incredible freaking film. You have your other ones, such as Emperor's New Groove, a Disney film, still slaps. You have your other simple Pixar films. When you say simple, it's these are things that also do the simplicity, but just do it to such a degree.
They understand the trope that they are attempting to do to a deep degree, that it is not cliche, that they are almost redefining the trope. It's no new example of what I look for is the trope. If I'm going to be looking at the monster movie tropes and all of the general storylines and beats that go along with that, like monster movies have been done over and over. Godzilla Minus One doesn't break the wheel or anything, but deeply understands the story structure and beats of it, that it is one of my new examples of, yes, the monster movie and the tropes and what does it mean? Yes, that of, you know, generally fear of great technological advance, like with Godzilla being the atom bomb, basically. It's like, this is perfect. It
Japanese
does it so well.
Guilt as well. Touched on so many incredible things. It's just what a film. We're getting off the point of the other ways that the American man would spend their time, of the Playboy magazine or the Westerns, which these are all things that feel more tangible, feel more real, could be, again, justified in this strange way, which goes to her point, because on the one hand, she says the Puritan, the Puritan who sees this pleasure as not a value, but then also says that her third point, the sexual mores of the person who watches pornography or does this other things for pleasure. Do you think is she listing out different types of men? Because it seems like the Puritan who sees that the simple stuff just going for pleasure would not be the same person that's falling into the sexual mores. Or
I think they are one and the same. You know, one man is a hypocritical beast. Mm-hmm. So hypocrisy, your name is man, but overall, there are pleasures that are easier to resist, and generally sex is one of the hardest things to resist for man. It's the driving factor of, you know, human nature. And so
we talked about breasts way too many times in this podcast already. Yeah.
Already. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's a lot easier to put down the book that is for fun, like to resist, you know, playing catch. Versus, you know, a beautiful woman throwing themselves at you. Both are temptations of different degrees. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think it's the same person.
And when it comes to answering, so Le Guin then goes on to, how can you convince this man to read? How can you get them to read? And she says, the man will ask, what's the good of it all? And this is what Le Guin says. The truest answer, unfortunately, he won't even listen to. He won't hear it. The truest answer is, the use of it is to give you pleasure and delight. She just says straight up, it's pleasure and delight. And then what the American man will say, well, I don't have the time for the pleasure. I don't have time for that. And the answer to that, Le Guin says, is the use of imaginative fiction is to deepen your understanding of your world and your fellow men and your own feelings and your destiny. That's the answer that Le Guin would give. And to which the man would answer that he's got, like, we talked about this earlier, of, hey, two cars, colored TV. He says, yeah, right, Le Guin. Like, look, I have all the things that I want. What else could I possibly want? And this is where it gets to my favorite line of what you get out of reading. This is what Le Guin says. I love this. And this is beautiful. Okay. She says, the kind of thing you'd learn from reading about the problems of a hobbit who is trying to drop a magic ring into an imaginary volcano has very little to do with your social status or marital success or income. Indeed, if there is any relationship, it is a negative one. There is an inverse correlation between fantasy and money. That is a law known to economists as Le Guin's Law. If you want a striking example of Le Guin's Law, just give a lift to one of those people along the roads who own nothing but a backpack, a guitar, a fine head of hair, a smile, and a thumb. Time and again, you will find that these waifs have read The Lord of the Rings. Some of them can practically recite it. But now take Aristotle Onassis or J. Paul Getty. Could you believe that those men ever had anything to do at any age, under any circumstance, with a hobbit. And so that quip she says about how certainly somebody off the side of the road you pick up, you know, hippie era in the 60s and 70s, would have read Lord of the Rings. And then the American man looks at it and goes, yeah, that's why I don't read Lord of the Rings. No wonder. That's what
there's
that's
a
the
reason why
they're into.
There's a reason why they have to beg for their food, and mm-hmm. I have three cars. They kept rereading Lord of the Rings to the point where they could repeat it. They have memorized it. I have done different things with my time.
Yep.
And to a point, there is some truth to that. There's a time and place for reading fiction. Like, once you have a roof over your head, once you are, like, you're not destitute, then read. Read your fiction then. But if you don't, if you don't have a roof over your head, get to work. Figure it out.
Yes. But the genius of the where this, again, article, it kept growing on me as it mm-hmm. made point by point. Very cool thing that she did here is she made the American man a fictional character. She made the generalization of American man in the 1970s and turned it into a character, as in, you know, mm-hmm. when you're building a character archetype, a lot of the times you'll have characters' wants, flaws, and needs. She presents this American man who's not reading fantasy as and getting all the things. You have the cars, you have the television, you're secure for your family. She presents all of that as, yes, that is what you want. That is your pleasure. You're getting and everything you want. And that's,
those things are not bad either. Those are admirable goals.
Awesome. You're doing the things you want. And I can't argue. Le Guin says, hey, if they're happy, I mean, that's what they want. But she then goes to argue it's not what they need. She argues that fantasy, this imaginative world, is a need that the wants and desires of the everyday Puritan, sexual mores, and businessman is not getting, even though they might look at that person on the side of the road and think, yeah, of course, look at my life compared to theirs. And it seems that you're doing all the things you want, but there's this hole, there's this imaginative vacuum that you are forgetting about. And that's what she's starting to piece this together. And I'm really, for me, this is where it was rolling into her final point. And which, do you want to jump in like that? The final point she makes, I mean, there, what do you think in the conclusion of her essay? What stuck with you?
The final point about, you know, childhood.
Yes.
And that an adult grown properly is not a new being, but simply a larger child. That you should that the impulses of childhood should not be snuffed out, but should be nurtured and evolved into a more complex and evolved form. Your inclinations of childhood should not be the right thing. Was she spent some time talking about the definition of discipline, that discipline does not mean repress, discipline means controlled. And so the inclinations of childhood should be disciplined. So a child's imagination, you know, when you see a child that cannot focus on what's in front of them and ultimately running out into, say, a traffic because they're, you know, daydreaming or whatever, like, that's uncontrolled imagination. But instead of stomping it out, you should discipline it. And so have it controlled where you can utilize it, grow it, have more imaginative thoughts. And so I like that idea of there's so many aspects of childhood that need to be nourished rather than repressed.
That's a great way that she puts it, because at that point about discipline being control, that's what discipline is. Not discipline isn't pushing something and trying to hide it, because mm-hmm. that's more, again, that's fear.
Yeah.
Why are Americans afraid of dragons?
Mm-hmm.
Repression is a fear. You're scared of it. Discipline is an understanding and a control. That's a great way to put it. And there's this quote she says about how all those billionaires in their photographs, they have this strange pinched look as if they were hungry, as if they were hungry for something, as if they had lost something, were trying to think where it could be or perhaps what it could be, what it was they've lost. Could it be their childhood? You know, she has this image of these billionaires who think they have everything that they want, but no, they might have not be able to recite Lord of the Rings, but hey, joke's on you.
They have three yachts.
But I have hobbits. What would you rather have? Le Guin asks. Now, yeah, it's hard to say I would rather have the hobbits. What about both?
I'll be honest, I've been on a handful of boats. I'll take the Lord of the Rings.
I'll also be honest, I don't want to ever own a boat. That's a lot of responsibility. It's a lot of upkeep, and you know, you just want, again, you want the friend with the boat. You don't want to own the boat. You want a friend with the dog. You don't want to own the dog.
I can't lie and say, like, a long-term dream of mine. Like, I want a sailboat when I am much older. I would love to own a sailboat. That would be a great
thing.
That's
exactly why I'm in the best position. Oh, I will have a friend with a boat.
Yeah. Like, I have a cat. You don't have to have a cat, but you get to pet a cat occasionally. With a cat. It's great.
I'm winning. I get all the benefits and none of the responsibility. And yes, that is how she does end the essay here. That I just want to quote these last two or so paragraphs because this is literature. Everybody listen, if you're in your car, if you're whatever you're doing, this is important to take away. She says, I believe that maturity is not outgrowing, but growing up, that an adult is not a dead child, but a child who survived. I believe that all the best faculties of a mature human being exist in the child, and that if these faculties are encouraged in youth, they will act well and wisely in the adult. But if they are repressed and denied in the child, they will stunt and cripple the adult personality, which is exactly what we were getting at.
Except better worded, because
we had to say Le Guin's words. This is now, I have this all boldened when I was highlighting the essay. So she says, for fantasy is true, of course. It isn't factual, but it is true. Children know that. Adults know it too. And that is precisely why many of them are afraid of fantasy. They know that its truth challenges, even threatens all that is false, all that is phony, unnecessary and trivial in the life they have let themselves be forced into living. They are afraid of dragons because they are afraid of freedom. Children know perfectly well that unicorns aren't real, but they also know that books about unicorns, if they are good books, are true books. All too often, that's more than mommy and daddy know. For, in denying their childhood, the adults have denied half their knowledge and are left with the sad, sterile little fact, unicorns aren't real. And that fact is one that never got anybody anywhere. And then she concludes by saying, it is by such statements as, once upon a time there was a dragon, or in a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit. It is by such beautiful non-facts that we fantastic human beings may arrive in our peculiar fashion at the truth. How profound is that?
I love it. Much better than the last essay we read.
Which one? Death of the Author?
Death of the
Screw
Author.
Screw that essay. That is God. Awful.
That was too awful. Pretentious even for us.
Yes. Le Guin brought it all home by saying this, and as lame as it sounds, because if I was at a bar with somebody and, you know, we're out with the boys, we're playing, everyone's watching sports ball, and I went, you know, guys, like fantasy, man, you know, fantasy and imagination is what's really important and what we all need. Immediately, everyone's going to be a fucking loser. Like, what are you?
We've been doing a pretty good job with our friends, though. We've been shifting them over from sports ball only to sports ball and fantasy.
You're right.
There's a place for both in their world.
However, if you were to say, hey, fantasy is more important than the sports ball stuff.
Oh, yeah, they would.
Come on. They're not there yet. There's pushback.
We'll get there, but one day.
It's just that sentiment comes across that this is what I would mean by when expressing why fantasy is important, of that adults, again, going off the fairy story, on fairy stories by Tolkien, this is where the two kind of correlate. And this is where Le Guin adds on to what Tolkien was saying about, no, it's not factual. Imagination, fiction, fantasy, it's not factual, but it is true. And that's an important distinction of what do you mean by true? And that, in these fantastical stories, this is where you can get the most value and the most progress as a human being as well. The most you can do for yourself sometimes is engaging with stuff like this. That is, again, this whole essay, I would not be able to express things unless reading this essay by somebody else who could say it smarter than me. A lot of times in life, you delegate. The businessman will delegate things that they don't want to do. Okay, here, I need an accountant. I need a lawyer. I need a doctor. I need all these different people to...
Books is a delegation of life experience.
Yes, and so when you're reading, we are able to read these stories by human beings who have put so much effort into getting some, again, good books. She does, I like how she distinguishes that and says, you know, unicorn stories, the good ones, the good unicorn stories are what we should focus on, because there's a, you know, there's still bad literature. There's still bad books out there. Doesn't mean everything's worth your time.
There is literature that edges itself a lot closer to pornography than pornography sometimes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, it's not all, it's all on this spectrum between just porn and, you know, Old Man in the Sea. Somewhere on that scale.
Wow. What a, yeah, those were two good examples.
Yeah.
And so, in summary, it seems that she's saying American men don't read fantasy because the Puritan values of avoiding pleasure, the businessman who, you know, fantasy hardly ever makes you rich, right? And sexual mores of it's seen as less manly and your imagination is repressed. So for those three reasons, men don't. But that's, they think they have what they want, but what they actually need are stories. Because fantasy, yes, it's pleasurable. She admits it's pleasurable. However, it's also true, and don't let non-facts prevent you from seeing the truth and beauty in fantasy. I, there's no better way to put it of that. That is why fantasy, to me at least, I will co-sign on that entirely of why fantasy is valuable. And she says, yeah, in her words, don't take my word for it. Take Le Guin's.
So if your friend is asking you, like, why do you read so much? What's the point in fantasy? It's just send them Ursula K. Le Guin's essay. And then there you go.
Yeah.
And you could tell them, guess what? This essay is not fantasy. It is not, it is factual statement. It is, you're learning something from it. There's a purpose. So you can get your rise and grind friend on the Lord of the Rings train.
Hell yeah. And that's also a funny thing to think about, of how Lord of the Rings in the 60s and 70s was a very hippie thing.
Oh yeah.
To read. You look today, it's not a hippie thing anymore.
No.
Definitely not. Like, I mean, if it could anything, still be a hippie thing, however.
Yeah, no, if anything, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
Which is weird. It's weird to think about.
Means Lord of the Rings is for everybody.
It is.
It's the best. All right, anything you want to add, Rich, to Le Guin's essay or the thoughts?
I did want to add in just at the very end here, the exception of, you know, fantasy and, you know, fantasy fiction, all that doesn't get you rich. Jeff Bezos would like to disagree. He spent his whole life and passion on selling books, and he's also a big fan of Lord of the Rings, and now he's...
Now he made Rings one of Power. The
and my counter-argument falls apart. But no, he likes Lord of the Rings, even if he can't adapt it to save his life, or, you know... That is honestly just proof of all the money in the world can't get you good literature. He has infinite money and he still couldn't make a good adaptation. And that was apparently something he cared about. Like, actually, all the other things, like adaptations, is about money at the end of the day. Apparently, from him, it was like, no, he actually really loves Lord of the Rings and this was a passion project. He really wanted this to happen. His infinite money couldn't make it happen. That's sad. That it really is sad. I would expect billionaire money to go a little further.
It comes back down to the art, the creator of what kind of passion do they put into the project? What vision do they have? What story do they want to tell? If it's about Galadriel.
We're not making fun of Galadriel. We're making fun of the way they said Galadriel. I just want
that
point clarified. Yes. Galadriel's the goat. Galadriel is not. That there's a difference.
Le Guin, you did it.
You did it again.
I think we should read this actual book with all of her essays in it, because there's probably a lot of gems in there.
Either that, or we piecemeal it out and really just stretch the content out, and we do each one its own video.
That's very businessman of you. That's your Puritan values are on fleek right now. What the fuck?
Someone needs to be the businessman between us.
All right. That's another Tudor Ramble episode. Thanks everybody for watching. We'll catch you on one where we're gonna do something stupid like a tier list, or we'll be YouTube-y again. Let us know if you do like these essay breakdowns. That's what we like.
Yeah.
So
thank you. Everyone.
Bye.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Let's be honest. Nobody likes having strangers in their house.
We've heard that 100 times from our clients at Simple Bath and Kitchen.
But then they meet our crew.
And suddenly it's, wait, can you stay for dinner?
We are not kidding. One customer tried to adopt one of our craftsmen.
At Simple Bath and Kitchen, we hire people you actually want in your home. Their parents, coaches, neat freaks, your neighbors.
You'll like having us around. Maybe a little too much?
Check us out at simplebathandkitchen.com or give us a call at 614-888-BATH.